He was playing tennis anyway with Gleason, who was the president of one of the ILA locals then. The ILA is the International Longshoremen's Association, and it was considered that, I mean, everybody knew that that was one of the racketeering unions. In fact, people were carrying on rank-and-file work in Brooklyn, too, and a longshoreman by the name of Pete Panto was murdered, and his body was found in a block of cement in I don't know which body of water. But usually, the gangsters did not bother too much with these, with the left-wingers that came down to the waterfront, because they were afraid of publicity. They mainly killed one another. Anyway, I had a few experiences with them, because I remember one night we visited the president of the local of 1258. That was the Clyde Mallory dock. And this friend was with the president, and we began talking, and this friend that was with him, anyway, they got a little drunk, and this other guy pulled out a blackjack, and it was really quite frightening. These are the kind of people we were dealing with. Anyway, a few years later, a newspaper reporter won a prize, I think it was the Pulitzer Prize, for his story about the loading racket.
Who was the newspaper? Do you remember?
I don't remember, and I don't remember what newspaper he worked for, but I believe this came out right at the end of World War II, because we were visiting this friend of ours who had been in charge of this longshore work for the party. He was living in San Francisco then, and he really began shaking when he read this story, because he hadn't believed it when we told him about the longshore conditions. He thought that was just an excuse for not, you know, getting farther with the longshoremen. Anyway, I used to go down there. I was working at the Air Reduction at that time. Air Reduction Company was a holding company for about 6 to 8 other companies: U.S. Industrial Alcohol, Pure Carbonic, Dry Ice, U.S. Oh, I said that. Anyway, quite a few different companies. And my job was to hire the office help for mainly Air Reduction and these other companies.
Who owned this company, the Air Reduction?
It was Percy Rockefeller Company. Oh. This is a big Rockefeller outfit. And you see, I had left the other job at the Educational Records Bureau, because I had finally asked for a raise, and the board of directors had agreed to give a raise, but it was going to be on the basis my raise money was to come out of what they would save by cutting the temporary workers who were college students from 50 cents an hour to 40 cents an hour. And so, anyway, I said goodbye to that job. I wasn't going to do anything like that. So I got this job at Air Reduction through an agency. And this was when I began going to the workers' school and finding that all this... Well, anyway... I began putting into practice what I was learning at the workers' school. In the first place, I would talk to the people that streamed in and day out, and explaining to them that it wasn't their fault they were unemployed, it was the system. I know it was such a relief to me when I got over the idea that I was supposed to be a success in life and business and all this business that you're brought up with, because I, at home in Spokane, I'd always had good grades and so forth and so on, and it was a relief to get rid of all that idea. So I was trying to help these people. I even had a list of addresses of the Workers' Alliance or Unemployment Council, I don't remember which it was called in those years, in the various areas of New York so that people that responded favorably, I could refer, give them the address of one of these, the offices of one of these in their own neighborhood. And that's one thing. I also was bringing literature there, and anyway, I was working there when I was working on the docks, and in the morning, and I would rush home from the docks and change my clothes and then go on to work. And after working there 2 years, actually, my boss, who was the personnel director, told me that I was her best assistant, which wasn't very flattering, because what she demanded of you was that you hire only WASPs. All the agencies had a code with all the companies. And number one girl was white, Anglo-Saxon Protestant. Number two girl was white, Anglo-Saxon Catholic. Number three girl was Jewish. Nobody else got on the list. Blacks didn't. Anybody with a foreign name wouldn't even be interviewed. And to show how backward some of these people personnel work were, this woman that I worked for, who was the chief personnel, she hired the executives of the company.
Who hired who?
I hired the office help. And she hired the executives. And she would, she believed in phrenology. And I would read her applications. I had to file her work too. And all these little notes would be written about the shape, the bones, the shape of the face. And she would hire people for jobs if they had a similar bone structure as one of the executives, you know, just on that basis. Anyway, she took me down to this phrenologist once, and the phrenologist said that I wasn't suitable for this. Anyway, I got fired after 2 years, but I never knew exactly what had happened, because I was carrying on so many things there that it might have been.
Which one was
affected? Yes. Because I was also bringing books for everybody who worked there to read, and I also was talking. Well, anyway.
Did you ever hire any number two or three girls, or was it?
Well, I hired a girl once that was partly Jewish, and I got in a jam for that. And but every time I went to the telephone to ask for someone, she would open the door. She knew when they were opening. She would tell me. And she would always say, now remember and hire a number one girl. So it really is a surprise, isn't it, to people that, well.
No, I'm not surprised.
Anyway, so that was, that's where I was working when I was going down to the docks in the morning. So this kept up for, just a few months, I guess, until in the spring of 1935, my sister Mary was going on vacation in New Hampshire with her progressive group. She was working in the library, and they were going to have vacation in New Hampshire.
Public
yes,
library.
Yes. She worked in the Lower East Side, where kids used to come to school in the wintertime. Some of them didn't have shoes, and their feet would even be bleeding. Anyway, they were going to have vacation, and I had agreed to go with them. And just before then, I had met this marine worker who later became my husband. That was Blair. And he and his friends were sleeping on the benches in the IWO. They were unemployed. There was lots of, you know, unemployment
there. In the unemployment hall?
Yeah. No, not the unemployment hall, in the IWO hall. That was the International Workers' Order. That was a very large insurance organization with groups, say, Czechoslovakian group, a German group, an English group. These were all foreign groups, a Hungarian group, a Russian group.
They're all immigrant workers?
All in the IWO. They carried insurance for the workers, you see. And at that time, there were a lot of foreign-born workers and children of foreign-born workers. And the IWO had millions of people. Anyway, that was one of the left-wing organizations, and these seamen were allowed to sleep on the benches there at night. I don't know where the benches were. I didn't ever see their place. But anyway, so when I went on vacation, I felt sorry for them when he told me this story, and so I invited them to stay in my apartment. And I went blackly on a vacation, and I did a lot of reading, and I became the cook because the cook didn't show up. And we worked building a road. We worked about, I'd say, 4 or 5 hours a day, road building, and I was excused from some of that because I was made the cook. When I got back to the apartment, I was very surprised to find that, the three marine workers were staying there, but they were having a little meeting, and they all had the Catholic rosaries around their neck, and they were refreshing themselves on the Hail Marys because they were planning this demonstration. And most of the policemen at that time in New York were Irish American Catholics. Oh, this was a demonstration. They were going to have a demonstration on the Bremen ship and pull down the flag to try to wake up the people in New York in the United States as to what was going on in fascist Germany.
What flag were they going to pull down?
The Nazi flag. Because, for instance, one of their seamen members, at that time these people were members of the Marine Workers Industrial Union, and one of their seamen had been arrested by Hitler and was in jail in Hitler Germany. So this demonstration was to show the American people, to bring it out in the open, what was going on in Germany, frankly. And also, they were demonstrating for this seaman and against the treatment of the Catholics in Germany and the rape of nuns and so forth by the Nazis. So here they were refreshing themselves on the rosary and getting prepared for the demonstration, which was to take place, I believe it was, the next day. Anyway,
I don't get the connection of the rosaries, because the policemen were...
They were going to wear they were wearing the rosaries because they expected to be arrested by these Irish cops who would be impressed if they saw the rosary, they might not arrest them, you see. Mm-hmm. In fact, that actually did take place, but I'll tell you about it. So, the next day, I was involved in the demonstration too, because we were called together, our unit and other groups, to appear down where the Bremen was docked, and we were to appear on the dock and have a demonstration and watch the flag being torn down. Well, my husband left with his friends, and...
Well, he wasn't your husband yet.
No. He wasn't my husband yet. But anyway, that night was quite an exciting night. Thousands, I can't remember how many, but thousands showed up on the dock where I was. And my husband had left with his friends, and they had bought roses to put in the lapel of their ship, and one of these one of these fellows, his name was Pat Gavin, he had a very strong Irish accent. He was born in Ireland, and so they got onto the ship with the story that they were going to see his old auntie off, because the ship was going to stop in Ireland, and he gave some name, and they got onto the ship. And as the demonstration was going on, and then we heard all ashore that's going ashore, and we thought, well, the flag wasn't going to go down. But we looked up, and there was a spotlight right on that part. A big party was going on the Bremen, you understand, at this time. Yes, with all the friends of all the people that were going to travel to Europe on this ship. And suddenly it's a very dramatic picture. You see the Nazi flag in the spotlight going down into the water, and everybody in our demonstration hurrayed and cheered, and it was very exciting. And then I heard this gun go off, and I, looking over at the ship, I saw them bring somebody out and throw him into this little booth where they had been taking tickets beforehand or something. Anyway, it looked like Blair, one of these three that I was telling you about, who later was to become my husband. So I figured, well, he was shot. Anyhow, we found out later he wasn't. But the demonstration then was to go on to the police station where the ones that were arrested were taken. So we walked up there, and...
Did you see them being arrested?
No. We knew they were arrested. But, and we were told by loudspeakers where they were being taken. I'd forgotten where the police station was, and that we should go on up there. So we went up there, and behind me, after I'd been there about 10 or 15 minutes, a big group of cops congregated right behind where I was, and you could tell that they were getting ready to charge the crowd. And this sort of infuriated me, and I was very young and naive anyway. When they charged ahead, I pounded one of the policemen on the back, you know. You really should not do that. And a Portuguese friend that was in our group that was with me, the cop came after me to arrest me, and this Portuguese fellow came over to rescue me, and he got arrested. He became one of these that was arrested that night at the other demonstration.
When he was trying to keep you from being arrested.
Yes, yes. And then they brought in Bailey. I saw him and said, bravo, something silly, and as they took him in to the police station. Yes, and we stayed there a little while, and then I went on. No, then I went back to the section headquarters and told the organizer, his name was Forbes, about that I thought my husband had been shot. No, he wasn't my husband yet.
I thought
Blair had been shot, and he really bawled me out and said, don't you know you're not supposed to be. This is serious business. You're not supposed to get emotional and worked up about anything like this. So, anyway, by the time I got home, I think it was about 4 o'clock in the morning. You know, you didn't dream of being afraid of being out on the street alone at night in those years in New York, during the Depression this was. Anyway, I got home about 4 o'clock, and here appears Gavin, who was one of those arrested. And he told me that he had gotten arrested, but that he had talked the cop out of arresting him and convinced him that he was just seeing his Abbey off because he had this Irish accent. And anyway, the Irish cop did let him off. So
it paid off.
And then he told me a little bit about it, how they had had to really force their way through this Nazi group of seamen in order to get at the flag. And he said the only weapon that Blair had was a pen, a fountain pen, I think, and I've forgotten what he had, but he had something, you know, some little thing, maybe just his fist. Anyway, they did get up and get the flag down. That was the important thing. And I was able to collect, $5,000 or $10,000 in bail money, I believe, for them afterwards. I got it mostly from my sisters, both of whom had good jobs there then.
So the next day, this was.
Yes, yes, this was the next day. And then the case went on, oh, I'm already up to there.
Well, where was Blair?
Blair was in the hospital. Oh, yes, you see, he had, that was he that was thrown into the booth, but he had just been quite badly beaten up. So he was put into the jail hospital along with Jolette, who had been shot. Now, Jolette was shot because he had nothing to do with pulling the flag down, but he was supposed to be in charge of the affair of getting the flag down. But because he had a big mouth and had been talking about it for some days, the Red Squad on the ship, the American Red Squad, New York Red Squad, was on the ship, you see, because...
And they knew that he was going to...
And they knew that it was going to be done, and they expected that he was going to do it. And when the flag went down, out of frustration, this cop just fired at him and shot him in the groin. So he and Blair were put into the jail hospital.
So they had known some days in advance that this was going to take place.
Yes, 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 yes. Well, the seamen knew. Now, we didn't know. We that went to the demonstration down below, we had just been told to come to a certain place at a certain time.
But the Red Squad knew.
But the Red Squad knew because this fellow had had really, you know, not talked too much. That's right.
Did they know at the time that they knew? No.
No, I don't think they knew knew. Although this guy should have known, because after all, if he had done a lot of talking, you would expect it to get back to the Red Squad. All these cities had Red Squads, just like Los Angeles has too, you know. So,
well, you collected how much bail, did you say? Was that the whole group?
Yes, I collected bail, and practically everybody got out on bail except Blair, because he was in the jail hospital,
and
he couldn't be out.
And
Jolette was in the hospital. In fact, I visited Blair in the hospital quite a few times, and he told me that he was getting fan mail from all over the country on it. And also, he looked healthier than I had ever seen him, because he had been beaten up. His face was full. It was swollen up from the beating, and it made him look much healthier.
He was and had a thin face.
Yes, yes. Oh, he was very thin. In fact, and he had a terrible cough. I'm sure he had TB at that time. But anyway, he really looked wonderful after this beating up. So I think he was kept in the jail hospital 2 or 3 weeks.
Did he have any fractures, do you remember?
Well, I think he maybe had had a little fracture in the concussion of the brain or something. And he, you know, they had broken, he had scratches or blood on his face and arms and various places. And I'm not supposed to go any farther, right?
There's still a little time.
Okay. Anyway, we went on. After he got out of the hospital and the court case took place,
there was some interval.
Oh, yes, and lots of things happened during that time. For instance, Fiorella LaGuardia was the mayor of New York. In fact, before I had any political ideas at all, I had worked for him in an election campaign. When I first arrived in New York, I was walking along under the elevated one place, and I heard this young person talking about the coming elections. And he was talking about the need for this, fusion candidate was LaGuardia. And he was giving all these stories about Tammany. And what they were like.
I mean, a lot in Tammany Hall.
Tammany had a lot of judges that couldn't even read and write. And I listened to him and was quite fascinated. So I volunteered, and I used to go out there in the daytime and help him. You know, at least it would be one person to start listening to him. So, in fact, I almost, when I think about that, I almost got lynched during that, because then when the elections took place, I was up in this voting booth, not a booth, it was a big warehouse, and there was an organization, a legal organization, that was working with the whole fusion candidates, and I went next door. There was just a door, and here was this other room where they were paying people to vote. So I tried to arrest someone, make a citizen's arrest, and I thought I was going to get lynched. But I got to the telephone, and the Honest Ballot Association, it was called, and they came down. Anyway, I got rescued. But that had all taken place before
they,
I...
They make an investigation then, the Honest Ballot Association?
Well, I mean, who would make the investigation? Tammany was in office still. But he did win, LaGuardia won the elections. Now, the reason I brought LaGuardia up is because I understood that, from what Blair told me, that the LaGuardia had called the Nazi flag, the black flag of piracy, and he had said that it was not going to be allowed to enter the port of New York.
LaGuardia said this.
LaGuardia. That's what I understood that Blair said. Anyway, from that time on then, all the ships came in, were able to come in with the Nazi flag because they changed the Nazi flag to the official flag of Germany. Before that, it had only been the party flag. So anyway, when the trial came up, my husband having been, oh, he wasn't my husband yet.
Well, Blair, let's just call him Blair.
He, at the trial, he heard the judge excused Bailey and Blair, three D's I think, Blackwell, that was another person I knew that was one of, that the they were let off, and he left his hat. Blair always wore a hat, and he had been leaving about every 10 minutes because he smoked an awful lot too, and going out to have a smoke, and he would leave his hat in the chair next door. So when he heard that he had been released, he left the hat in the chair so that the immigration, whom he had seen there in the back waiting for him, would think
that
he was coming back, because he noticed that they hadn't been paying much attention. So he was able to get out and come home. I say home by now because Blair, the other two had moved out, but Blair just stayed in the apartment with me.
And what Blair was a citizen of what country?
England. He was Liverpool Irish, but he was born in Liverpool. In fact, he had been, well, he worked on a barge from the age of about 12, and his father was a longshoreman, and then he had been a longshoreman there. So anyway, when he was released, he came back to the apartment. He said, "We have to get out of here because the immigration are after me, so we'll go to Baltimore." So I quickly made arrangements to move the furniture. I don't know how we knew the address then. I don't remember the details of this, but in just a few days, we moved down to Baltimore and got our furniture down there. Yes. And lived in an apartment, got an apartment that seemed wonderful for the price. I think it was like $12 a month. It was the whole second floor of a house. It had a living room and bedroom, and then in the back was the kitchen and the bathroom. Well, it turned out later, when the snows came and it got cold, we lived only in the kitchen and the bathroom because that part we could keep warm with the kitchen stove. And the water in the bathroom froze, and the tanks, the pipes broke. But we had water in the kitchen, all right, because it's one of those places where you have the bathtub in the kitchen, and it has a big cover that comes down next to the sink, so you can do the dishes, and then you put the top up if you want to take a bath.
Yeah.
So that's part of the Baltimore story. But also, I got a job there, because when we got down there, there had been a gang in Baltimore that was terrorizing the seamen. It was called the Warner's Gang, because that was the name of the leading person in it. And this was, I got a job in Washington, D.C., I think through the influence of my uncle, because Secretary of War Dern at that time, they were honest and they called it the Secretary of War, not of Defense. Truman put in the defense business so that people would think they were defending their country by making the moral weapons.
So you got a job.
So I got a job in the WPA administration in Washington, D.C.
I think you better stop now.
Okay.